Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Paul C. Toomey, comics historian, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Screwball, The Cartoonists Who Made the Funnies Funny. Paul, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this crazy book.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be here, as Bill Holman, artist of Smokey Stover, might say. Foobulous. It's absolutely foobulous.
This is, you describe this book, and I love this, The Legacy of Graphic Nonsense. A lot of these comics, most people may not even know about anymore. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, even diehard comic fans.
Oh, yeah.
You know, grab a comics history book. At least half of the artists in my book, you're not going to find a single word about them.
Well, first of all, everybody, when they write these big histories of comics, you know, everybody gravitates towards Tarzan and Flash Gordon and all the big ones.
Right.
All the serious.
Yeah.
And these crazy comics get short shrift. And so it's so amazing to see these put in a big format, amazingly reproduced book. But is there a formal definition of screwball comics?
Well, not really, no. It's a retroactively applied term, and it's kind of interesting because the term was first appropriated by film scholars in the 1960s, you know, to describe a certain type of Hollywood romantic comedy that came out of the Great Depression, you know, films like It Happened One Night
or
Preston Sturges movies. But screwball really is kind of an adjective more than a genre or a form. And, you know, originally it meant it was a type of pitch, right? You have the screwball pitch in baseball. And prior to that, you had it in cricket. It shows up in the mid-1800s as a description of a pitch in cricket. And then somewhere in the 30s, it came to be known as a slangy term for an eccentric or a madman or a nutcase or just a plain fool. And people like Paul Gallico and Ernest Hemingway and P.G. Woodhouse started to use it to spice up their magazine short stories, and it became a descriptive term for a while. But the people who drew these comics did not call their form screwball. So there's no formal definition of it. I attempt, to define it in the introduction to screwball. And in the first sentence, I use the following adjectives: manic.
Yep.
Ludicrous.
Yep.
Grotesque. Grotesque is very important. That if there was one word, I mean, that's what Rube Goldberg called his comics in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He called them grotesque. Eugene Zimmerman was considered to be the king of the grotesque cartoons. It had a different meaning back then than it does today, which is kind of like a horror show. But back then, it just meant elaborate exaggeration. But also, these cartoons were compressed. You know, there's more than just one joke. There's multiple jokes stuffed into these panels, and they're dreamlike. They foreshadow the sensibility of the surrealist and the Dadaist. So they're very, very interesting material to work with.
Now, it's interesting because this book focuses on the 1880s to the mid 20th century, but I'm old enough to have grown up with the original Mad Magazine comic, when all the great artists like Jack Davis were doing these crowded panels where all sorts of weird stuff was happening. And that's what they remind me of, that there are these crowded panels that, and there's a sense of anarchism to some of these too, that is just crazy. I mean, it's wild comics. Where did people read these? Was it just in the Sunday newspapers?
Well, actually, they were sort of came up and they originate, in America in the humor magazines that just predated the development of the American newspaper comic strip.
Okay.
And that's one of the interesting things that I found out in my research as I kept going backwards and backwards and backwards. I sort of started with Mad, and the question was, who influenced Harvey Kurtzman and Will Elder and Jack Davis and all those guys to do these crazy comics, because it didn't come out of the blue? And then who influenced those influencers? And as you go back, you discover a magazine called Puck and another one called Judge and several other humor weeklies And it turns out it's driven by a technological change, essentially. The cartoons and the graphics that appeared in publications in the 1800s in America and other countries were done by carving into wood blocks. And for a larger cartoon that was topical, like Thomas Nast political cartoons, they would break them up into sections. They would saw the wood block into like six different sections and give them to six different people to start carving these cartoons out. And I mean, it's just mind-boggling, you know. It's like building the pyramids to make a cartoon. So they were very expensive to make, and they were very time-consuming. So that's why you don't see a lot of graphics. But then somewhere around 18, I don't know the exact date, 1875, 1876, a new process was developed where they could use chemicals to etch into metal. And, you know, the remaining image would be a printing plate. And suddenly it became really easy to do black and white graphics, not color. Color had to be done in lithography. And you can see some of those reproduced in the book, in the first two chapters of the book on Frederick Opper and Eugene Zimmerman. There's some beautiful color lithographs in there. And there's even a photograph of Zimmerman.
Right.
It's, you know, it's a sort of hoary old cliche to show a photograph of the artist at the drawing board, and we have several of those in the book. But in this photo of Eugene Zimmerman, he's not sitting at the drawing board, he's sitting on a lithograph stone. So the book actually goes back to the Stone Age.
Your choice of artist in this book is really fascinating, because you've really gone for the lesser known or poorly known artists, I should say. So you've left out
not
people.
All of them.
No.
Some
and
of
I'm
going
to talk about that in a sec. So you left out Al Capp, Walt Kelly, but
right.
You've included George Harriman, my favorite, Rube Goldberg, and one of my other favorites is E.C. Segar, which if most people don't know the name, they know the product. And we'll talk about
Bye-bye.
That in just a second. But let's start out with the first artist that you consider, which is who's Frederick Burr Opper, 1857, 1937. As you write, he doesn't look funny himself. He looked like an insurance salesman or some kind of clerk.
Winsor McKay said you would never know that this man was the leading humorist in the world. He looks like he's the guy coming to collect the rent.
He started doing political cartoons.
Right.
Especially in Puck. Is that true for a lot of the artists that they start off doing very serious things? And then they grab it.
Yeah. The graphics. I mean, if you go look in Harper's Weekly and Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper, which are the publications that were using these woodblock cartoons, you're going to find some humor cartoons. Ones that are even in the Screwball Spirit of Mad. There were some in there that I just loved. But by and large, like 90% of it is aimed at political issues. But what happened with the explosion of cartoons in the humor weeklies was there was so much more bandwidth for cartoons that in Puck, Opper's big spreads, and the big spreads of the other cartoonists are all political. But then the black and white little filler cartoons start becoming commentaries on social activities, and then they start becoming commentaries on the relationship between men and women, or the classes, or technology, all sorts of interesting, fascinating things. And that's where the humor cartoon really starts to develop. And out of that, we get the first material in the newspaper comics, and then it sort of takes off. Rube Goldberg was really the first guy to sort of hit it big, and he set a model for all the people that followed. But I probably am overstepping my bounds. I, to talk about Frederick Opper, I think he probably is the single most overlooked cartoonist in comics.
Well, it's interesting.
Didn't know that much about him.
I've actually seen reproductions of Happy Hooligan, and her name was Maud. But you know where I saw it? I saw it in a British book about comics. an American book, but a British book about it. Well, who was Happy Hooligan?
Well, Happy Hooligan was a tramp and a comic strip character. He came along in 1900, in March of 1900, and had a long, long life. He, Opera drew him basically for the rest of his career, lasting until the early 30s. And Hooligan The tramp stereotype was very common in vaudeville, and you know, you'll see it in early movies. I mean, look at Charlie Chaplin. And author's twist on the character, I reprint the first Happy Hooligan in the book, which is hilarious to me. But the second strip that I reprint of Happy Hooligan is a little bit later, and we were lucky enough to find some source material from an unpublished interview by Omper in which he says the character dragged frightfully at first. That's a quote. And it sounds a bit British there. And, you know, he said, then he hit upon the idea of investing him with the idea that he's trying to help people. So he's always rushing into situations to try to help people, but he's so incompetent and such a boob, such a bungler, that he ends up creating a wide swath of chaos. You know, by the end of the strip, people are, you know, hurt, wounded, buildings are torn down, and he's being dragged away by one of the ever-present policemen that's always on a street corner in the Happy Hooligan strips. And that became successful. And that's really significant because this to me, is the dawn of humor or character-based, character-driven comedy.
The look of the people in these strips is to a comic effect. So feet are huge, noses are bulbous. There's things like screwballism, as you talk about in the book. There's the screwball spin, the plop take. All that starts to develop at this point, which now becomes like, you know, it's a cliche now, but it was new then.
It was new then. And the screwball spin is a label that I came up with as the word screwballism. I figure if you can have futurism and cubism, surrealism, you can have screwballism. It's a bit of a joke.
Yeah, but you got to describe what a screwball spin is.
Right. A screwball spin is where it's the climactic penultimate panel where you have the characters either like slipping on something and falling down the stairs, or they're fighting with each other. And Opera draws these amazing windmills of pinwheels of frenetic action that's they're all blurred, you know, and there's like five heads and 12 arms. And
I always think of Popeye having a fight with Bluto, one of those things where it's just like,
right. It's that same just furious action. And another thing that's really fascinating to me about this is it looks like freeze frames from a movie, right? And I feel like the technology of the movies must have influenced Opera at this point. You know, going to the movies and seeing these blurry images when people would move so fast must have influenced the idea of drawing this, and it became one of his signatures. And then you begin to see it picked up elsewhere as well. Another interesting point about Happy Hooligan that I should mention is he's credited by some scholars, that strip is credited as having the first use, continuous use of word balloons in comics. You'll find them in earlier comics, but they're not continually used. They're just kind of a novelty.
Yeah.
But in Happy Hooligan, it became the basis. And the reason why I think he created the speech balloons was to give his so you could understand that Happy Hooligan was trying to do a good deed, and it always blew up in his face.
You're listening to WICN. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Paul C. Toomey, comics historian supreme. And we're talking about his new book. It's a big format chunk of a book that's wonderful. Screwball! The cartoonists who made the funnies funny. We're going to run out of time before I've talked. I know this is because, and I love this, but I want to talk about some of the more well-known artists. Let's talk about George Harriman. Now, everybody knows George Harriman now for Crazy Cat and also his work, on Archie and Mehetable. Okay. But what you reprinted in the book is this really crazy strip called Stumble In. Talk about that.
Well, Stumble In is kind of like the antecedent to Fawlty Towers, if people know that show.
Yeah.
Please. A real similar setup. It's a seedy old rundown hotel run by a proprietor who has rather frustrated ambitions of upward mobility, and then he takes it out on the people that work for him. And it allows for a continuous stream of eccentric characters to come and go in the strip. And Harriman was drawing this strip while also doing Crazy Cat, which is mind-boggling.
Wow.
Because the art in the strip is just gorgeous. Art Spiegelman, you know, when he reviewed the book for the New York Review of Books, said, you know, it was some of the best cartooning he had ever seen, some of the most beautiful cartooning that he had ever seen. And the point of reprinting Stumble In instead of the other stuff is a lot of the other Harriman material is currently in print. And that's kind of the philosophy of this book, is to fill in some of the gaps and not just reprint the same old stuff and say the same old things about the cartoonist. I wanted to do a deeper dive into comics history.
Just to give an example of the strange humor, at one point the guy wants to sign his name, so it's not really legible, and he gets a fly to write his name. And it's this bizarre thing where this fly sort of walks across the paper and creates his name. It's an amazing strip. I had not seen those, and I can't believe he was drawing Crazy Cat at the same time. Now, I'm going to rush ahead because I'm going to lose time.
Yeah.
Rube Goldberg, I want to talk about. As you describe him, he was fearlessly silly. He was prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a celebrity. Is he the first celebrity comic artist?
Yeah, he was. I don't know if he was the first celebrity cartoonist, because Opper and Eugene Zimmerman and many others before him were famous. But there was something special about Goldberg. He was the first American comic strip artist to hit it big. And that happened when his work became syndicated. They started selling his comic strips, you know, out to other papers, and he became a national sensation around 1910, 1911. And then around 1915, you see articles about his salary, not just him and his art.
Wow.
How much money he was making, and they would publicize that. And that inspired a whole new generation of cartoonists.
No doubt.
No doubt.
Yeah, I want to be that guy. I want to pull down the big bucks. But
he was the first millionaire cartoonist.
Now, most people know him for his strange contraptions.
Right.
And they start out as comic strips, like How to Strain Soup Through a Full-Grown Beard. But he did all these other strips. Mike and Ike, they look alike. Is that where the candy name came from?
Yes. Very, very obviously, that's where the candy name came from. And he had another strip called Lollapalooza. That's where we get that word from.
Wow.
He inserted a lot of things into the American vernacular. No matter how thin you slice it, it's still baloney, if you've ever heard that thing.
Yes.
And, of course, the word boob, that was a word coined by H.L. Mencken, but Rube Goldberg made it his own. You find it all over the place, including a character, a long-running Sunday comic strip series called Boob McNutt. But, yeah, his invention cartoons are what we know him for today, and that comprises maybe just a few percentage points of his total output, which he estimated was around 50,000 cartoons. So his humor work is a vast treasure of American culture that remains unreprinted and undiscovered today. It's just waiting to be unearthed. It's wonderful stuff, I can tell you. I have piles of this stuff, and I love it.
Paul, well, that brings up one of the things I thought about all the while reading this book, is there a danger that strips can be lost because nobody preserved the papers or saved the original artwork?
Yes, absolutely. There, in chapter 14, we cover the work of Ving Fuller, brother of Sam Fuller, the filmmaker. And they both worked for a newspaper called the New York Evening Graphic, which was considered to be the first tabloid newspaper. You want to talk about fake news, these guys did it in spades. And it was considered, even at the time, to be a fish wrapper, you know, just completely ephemeral. So it was never preserved, never saved, never microfilmed. They're very hard to find. I couldn't find any at all after looking for years. And within there, you'll find the early work of Ernie Bushmiller, creator of...
Oh, wow, Nancy.
Nancy. He had a strip in there called Mac the Manager. And you got Ving Fuller strips, and you have strips by several other noted cartoonists, and then columnists like Walter Winchell. That's where he got his start, Ed Sullivan.
Wow.
So that's a big loss. However, in the 70s, when libraries made a big push to convert their bound newspaper volumes to microfilm, And then they threw out the microfilm. They threw out the newspaper volumes, many of which were rescued by Bill Blackbeard. Thank you, Bill. And are now, now reside in the Billy Ireland cartoon library at Ohio State University. But this stuff is really rare and hard to find. But what's wonderful is, if you don't mind looking at cruddy, muddy microfilm versions, especially of the color Sundays, you can find them in the comfort of your own home by going to places like newspaperarchives.com or the Library of Congress has a great site, and you can find, that one's free. Well, it's paid by our taxes, but they're around. So in fact, getting this stuff online is what made this book possible.
Right.
I could not have done this book 20 years ago. This book couldn't have been done 20 years ago. The internet made this book happen. And so you're going to find a lot of information in here that just wasn't available before about the cartoonist.
Well, I have to talk about E.C. Segar. Is that how you pronounce it? Or Segar?
That's how Segar. I think he always drew a cigar next to his name, so I figure that's how he wanted it pronounced. That means sea spear in I think it's Norwegian. Isn't that interesting?
It is weird.
Create a sea character.
Now he did some early strips using Charlie Chaplin. Mm-hmm. He did Looping Loop, but he's most well known for Thimble Theater, and that to me is a very important strip. Thimble Theater originated Popeye, J. Wellington Wimpy, the Sea Hag. The list is endless. All those characters started out in Thimble Theater.
Yeah, Alice the Goon, the Jeep.
The Jeep. I know. What a great character
Eugene
that is.
The Jeep. Yeah, yeah. He eats orchids, and when he wags his tail, he becomes invisible. And 10 years later, the military picked it up to describe their utility vehicle, the Jeep.
But I love the way you describe J. Wellington Wimpy. Eloquently spoken, but morally bankrupt.
Thank you. I love that character.
Oh, my, I do too. I do too. Everybody knows, I'll gladly play you Tuesday for a hamburger today, but few people remember, come up to the house sometime for a duck dinner, you bring the ducks.
Yes. Or you must have me mistaken for one of the Jones boys, or let's you and him fight, or I would like a hamburger with pickle, lettuce, and onion both. He had so many. It was so funny. And Segar had just had a wonderful sense of humor. And on top of that, he was a wonderful cartoonist. He developed into one slowly over time, day by day. You can see his style get reduced. He starts out drawing this Charlie Chaplin comic strip, and it's terrible. Poorly drawn. And then he does Looping the Loop, which is so tiny he has to almost draw stick figures. You can see olive oil starting out in there. And that enabled him to kind of rebuild his cartooning style from the ground up. And a few years later, you get these wonderful rounded forms in Popeye, and these, he's building on the tradition of screwballism, like with the we talked about the screwball spin and the blurry pictures the frenetic action. And then he begins to tell these really long stories, sometimes which last a year or a year and a half. They're long continuities that are adventures.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like Don Quixote. It just goes on, and there's one comic scene after another with these long, continuing, funny characters. And so that's why if I had to go to a desert island and pick one comic strip to bring with me, it would be Thimble Theater, because it's got it all happening. It's a wonderful comic.
But he also did this really funny, weird character. Sappo with the big nose.
Yes, I love Sappo, and that's the one I
mean, a really, it's like a Pinocchio like nose that just goes everywhere.
That's in that particular instance. Sappo's nose is normally about the size of a cinnamon bun, but
that's an odd comparison. as opposed to a Dunkin' Donut. So, but a cinnamon bun is a fairly large nose.
Yeah, it is. It's a bulbous nose. Seagar had a thing about big noses. You can see it in one of the Looping the Loops that's reprinted in the book. He's doing a whole riff on big noses. He had a thing about it. He has an early character in Thimble Theater called Ham Gravy, who has a big nose. And there's, I found some, it's not in the book, but I found some press release where Seagar is quoted as saying, Ham saw a banana when he was a child in it. And that's why, you know, he was shocked, so shocked that that's why his nose grew to such a large size. So he thought, big noses and big feet were quite funny, and they're all over the place in his comic strip. And the amazing, the ultimate version of this is the continuity I reprint in the book of Sappho, which was a topper that ran above Thimble Theater, where a mad scientist named Professor Wattisnozzle invents an ointment that makes things grow. And, of course, within, 10 seconds, somehow it gets on Sappho's nose, and it starts growing. And, you know, in the first strip, it's growing a little bit, and then the next week, it has it's poking through the newspaper he's reading, and the next week, it's going out the window, and the next week, it's going through the neighbor's windows. The next week, it's going through a vacant lot and scaring kids who think it's a snake. And finally, it comes in. It goes out one window, and then it comes in the window behind him and bumps him in the head. It's a wonderful sequence.
We're almost out of time. It seems that the post World War II, the sort of the desire of the public to see these screwball comics sort of diminished, and they went out of fashion. But it's interesting because I look at animation today. You look at something like SpongeBob SquarePants or Ren and Stimpy or something like that. That seems to have screwballism written all over it.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. The spirit is still very much alive with us today.
But not in the strips, though. Not in those comics.
Not in comic strips. Yeah, they went into newspaper comic strips in the late 30s and did a cross-pollination over to comic books. So you have people like Jack Cole.
Yep.
Harvey Kurtzman, who created Mad Magazine, and so on and so forth.
I just want to end by saying Nav Shah's Kapop.
Hey, can I make a little announcement?
Sure.
The first public announcement of this, I found this out 30 minutes ago. The book has been nominated for an Eisner Award.
It deserves it. It deserves it. I can tell you that right away. This is amazing. My guest tonight has been Paul C. Toomey, comics historian, and we've been talking about Screwball! The cartoonists who made the funnies funny. There are many hours worth of enjoyment just looking at the comics, but reading the biographies is fascinating. Paul, I hope to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Mark. And if you're ever in Seattle, come on over to the house for a duck dinner.
I'll bring the duck. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.